definitely was no change in welcoming the
Good morning and welcome. I'm Lindy Wilson, a member of the Portfolio Committee.
Good morning. I'm Philip van Staden, member of the
Committee. Good morning. Dr. Susan Kembekwayo, member of Committee on Health. Thank you.
I am Sevewe Kwakube. I'm the member of the Committee.
I am Magdalene Slengwa, member of Committee.
Good morning. This is Okacha, member of the Committee.
Good morning, Anakela, member of the Committee.
Good morning, I'm Kenny Jacobs, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Thank you very much, honorable members, for introducing yourself. TG, I'll come to you last when you will then introduce your team and then you'll start with the presentation. But let me just say to you, thank you very much for coming in here. We are aware that the minister is not here today. We decided that we may not need him, but we definitely need the minister tomorrow when he goes to the NHI. We have met as a committee this morning. We are listening to what we call a legacy report. Other people prefer, as I do, to call it a handover report. The first time that we are meeting as a health professional committee, after the rush of passing the budget, looking into the APP, right now we want to actually understand every work that we need to do. So the first part that we needed to do was to listen to the legacy report. On the legacy report, there are certain outstanding issues, both from our side and from the department. Ms. Machalamba is going to assist you by indicating those outstanding points that you need to respond to, but very much critically here is what we call an NHI pilot site report. Wherever we have piloted, it's going to assist us that report in our deliberations starting with you tomorrow. You could make a reference to tomorrow as to where is it sitting, how is it going, how does it impact our work going forward. We will really write a whole host of other things, but you probably do know things that you presented to the 5th Parliament Portfolio Committee and were then left unattended to, which we then have to, we can't dismiss it and disregard them, take them on board as part of our work. And therefore, I thought it would be important to raise those issues. One of the things that we reflected on ourselves was to say the portfolio committee before us called all provinces to come and make a status report on the mental health care. Probably it was provoked by things that happened in the city meeting. We say to ourselves, we have to prepare ourselves going forward to make sure and monitor whatever that they put in place is working, so that we don't have another city main. But number three, this committee, among other things, would really like to be appraised by that city main issue. We know it has gone this way, that way, that way. What is it that is there for us to still monitor, check, and understand? It's not for today, it's for those aspects. So I'm just highlighting things that we think are outstanding from your side, that we, in our next meeting maybe, we will not ask you to come and meet with us on this and that. You will have to start with the outstanding issues first, which maybe we will collect. Ms. Machalamba will also confirm with you that these are the outstanding, and you collect those reports and agree. It's up to you to indicate that if there are things that are outstanding, there are 7, 8, you can't cover all of them in one day, we can make arrangement. But we just want to be taken on board on those processes. I wanted to share with you my report. This report must... Miss Honorable Chanji, can you go to the report?
Yes.
DG, we know that you have brought with you some colleagues from various entities. Some of them I'm even not, I'm afraid to look at them, but some of them were my former bosses in some other parts of life. But now, I have to call them to order and ask reports. Very challenging responsibility that I have. But I would want to share with the entities that are here while we're introducing them that today we are here, tomorrow we're also here. But tomorrow, after the presentation of the NHI by the department, we would like to also receive a briefing by the Council of Medical Schemes on its mandate, annual performance plan and budget. I'm sure those who are here, who come from that sector, will already be aware we need them again tomorrow afternoon. On the 4th of September, we will be meeting and getting a briefing by the Compensation Commissioner for Occupational Disease on its mandate, annual performance plan and budget. We then, before lunch, we'll have a briefing by the Office of the Healthcare Standard Compliance. Because there's a plenary on that day, we have pleaded with the members to adjourn at 1 and reconvene at 4 to listen to the briefing by the South African Health Products Regulatory Authorities, SAHPRA, on its mandate annual performance plan and budget. On the 18th of September, we are going to be listening to a briefing by the NHLS on its mandate annual performance plan and budget, and also a briefing by the MRC. We have taken the interest of our honorable members to say, sometimes we might do it both, listen to the presentation but also visit. That's why on the entity we are requesting Dr. The MRC president, to host us in the morning while we are listening to the NHLS, and therefore she will then take us around her building and what they're doing there, while in the afternoon we'll listen to their presentations. We'll try and visit other entities as we listen to the presentations, but for now we just want to go to Pinelands. Pinelands, where you are?
Yes.
Yeah, whatever, that, okay, not very far from Pinelands. Yeah. We'll be there, starting with NHLS. So I don't know too many towns here, just know this area. So, this part, Ms. Masoso, you already have, but I just took an advantage that the entities that you are going to introduce now are here, so that they could note that we already have approved our visits to or our sitting and meeting with them. I now hand over to you to, one, introduce the delegation you are with, and therefore you start with the presentation. We are just closing. We hope that the members are going to be very kind to you, because here you are outlining what you are really doing in the department. And I pleaded with the members, and they agreed that for us it's mainly clarity-seeking questions. It's not going to be a question to say, we asked you to do this, why have you not done that, and this and that. That part we don't have. This to us is a very important session. It's going to assist us to have our own strategic planning and the portfolio committee with a full understanding of all the entities, what they are doing, and therefore yourself. So the visits of the entities is also key to us, because having visits, all of them will then be able to go and regroup as a portfolio committee and to actually deal with our work based on what you have presented to us. I now hand over to you, and I'm going to be quiet at least for the rest of the morning. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, and thank you for inviting us. I'm here with the the executive managers of the Department of Health, the DDG, starting with the CFO, Mr. Ian van der Merwe, the head of corporate services, Ms. Tiny Rain, the head of communicable and non-communicable disease, Dr. Jorgen Pile, and COO, Dr. Andrews, also responsible for human resource for health, research, monitoring and evaluation, Dr. Anban Pile, responsible for national health insurance, and Ms. Annelisa Qele, who is acting in Ms. Jeanette Hunter's position, because as you may recall, Ms. Hunter is administrator in Northwest after it was put under administration. So she is acting but also doing her normal day-to-day duties. We also have Mr. Bobo Maja, who is our head of communication. He was sitting there, he disappeared. We have our parliamentary officer, Mr. Khata, who is known to most members. We then have the heads of, I don't know whether because of the church, we have Mr. Cindy Lesodaga also. I don't know because of church whether they are standing outside or what, but you can establish they still have to appear because they are part of the delegation. We, based on the correspondence that was sent to us, we interpreted that you expected the heads of entities to be present. It wasn't because they were going to be presenting, but to be part of this workshop. I had understood it to be a workshop. So we have from NHLS Dr. Chetty, Dr. Kis Nasani from CCO. Dr. Chetty. He's not Dr. Chetty. Dr. Chetty. Yeah, that's Dr. Kemi Chetty. NHLS. And Dr. Kis Nasami, CCOD. Dr. Kabani, Council for Medical Team. Medical Research Council, Professor Satecha and Professor Gray.
Dr. Mchali, MBOD.
And Dr. Mchali from
MBOD.
MBOD. You probably know the laws for diseases that affect the lungs in the mining industry. We have both MBOD and COD that are provided for in terms of the Act. Lastly, we've got South African Health Products Regulatory Authority, POSHA, and we have an official who works with these entities. You'll see her quite often when you invite the entities to Mishoti, Mishwana. That's the whole thing. And a parliamentary officer from the Office of the Deputy Minister. Thank you, Chair.
Before you start your presentation, thank you very much. We have since been joined by another honourable member, Honourable Chirwa. I was going to request Honourable Chirwa, if it is possible, to get your chair and bring it here next to Honourable Janti, and then you create a space there, not without a chair, that they could put other members there. So you could come in here. I don't know who's going to assist you to carry your chair.
Please move on.
Mr. Maja has since arrived and he's standing, still doesn't have a chair.
Dr. Krishna Sam can push her chair into that slot.
Dr. Machali.
We have just been joined by this honorable member, Honorable Chirwa. She's an alternate member also in this committee. DG, we're up to you now, so you can start your presentation. Members, if you note clarity-seeking questions, I would wish that we note them rather than to stop at the, let the presentation flow, then we can be able to ask questions. She will then decide who of the team that are here with her will support her in the
Thank you, Chair, and I must start by first apologizing for sending you lengthy presentation. I just wanted to make sure that you have as much information as possible. I've sent you three sets of presentation. The last presentation is actually the five-year strategic plan, which is being presented, yes, NDP, it's the implementation of the National Development Plan that runs into the next 5 years. I thought it was necessary because it will answer some of the questions as to what is it that is planned for the next 5 years. But for purposes of this presentation, I'd like us to focus on this. The other is basically background. If we have time, we'll probably use some time to have a presentation on that. Chair, the outline of this presentation is mainly in the following areas. First is the background, just to inform the committee as to what drives our agenda. It's mainly the Sustainable Development Plan, the National Development Plan, but more recently the compact that was signed between the president, various stakeholders, and government. So I thought I needed to give that kind of context. I'll present that and the demographic profile. And the significance of presenting the demographic profile is precisely because it has implications for how we plan and also how we allocate resources. Thirdly, it's about the health status. And we have to, as we talk about the health status, bear in mind what the demographics are and how resources are allocated. But the next one will be about the health system. There's a particular framework that WHO presents. And if you look at this framework together with the Health Summit Compact, you'll see that there's some level of alliance and how the services are organized. And lastly, what matters most, what does it mean for our patients? I thought I needed to give that context so that there's sort of a particular narrative. So these are the sort of background documents that I thought you could refer to. Firstly, just finished a 25-year review, broadly as government, but in particular the health sector, as to how we've performed, where the gaps are, where the problems are, so that as we plan for the next 5 years and also in going, you know, towards achieving the Sustainable Development Goals and our National Development Plan goals, we need to have learned from these 25 years. And secondly, the data that comes out of our demographic health profile from Census, MRC, you'll see these have been referenced in my presentation. We work very closely with MRC because they conduct on a regular basis a rapid mortality surveillance, because we have to have an understanding as to whether our interventions work and whether mortality is going down and so on. You'll see that you have the most latest report that was released in January. But more importantly, we also have, because there's been, you know, a lot of talk about quality of the services in the public health sector. Chair, I served on the Global Commission established by Harvard, and the Lancet produced a report, the Global Report. But there was also a couple of countries that were selected, and these countries were specifically targeted at, you know, because they had a number of initiatives that they were involved in on quality, and South Africa produced a Lancet a commission report, the national one. And we also have the evaluation report that you referred to, which was about phase one of the NHI pilot site. But I must also hasten to say that in addition to the evaluation report, we've got appraisals that were conducted on an annual basis, and those we've always shared with the portfolio committee, but they will be available as well to the committee, so that as you read the evaluation report, you can also read the appraisal report. The Presidential Health Summit Compact, which I referred to earlier, which has somehow also influenced the plan, and it's also aligned to the WHO health system framework, and the provincial, the provisional findings of the health market inquiry, which is chaired by Judge Moore. So these are sort of areas where we'd like to respond, but these are the two important documents for us. The first one is the on the left, the Sustainable Development Goals and the NDP, like I said. On the right hand side is the medium-term government-wide plans, and the draft that I've already submitted to you is beginning to deal with these five-year plans that will be approved as soon as the subject of what drives of our work and agenda in the next 5 years. So these are the pillars of this compact that was signed in July. It was signed recently, but as you know, it involved a whole lot of stakeholders, labor, private sector, civil society, government, and led by presidency. And it deals with human resources for health, essential medicines, equipment, infrastructure, engagement of private sector, improvement of quality, but also financial management systems, how we can improve their efficiency, governance, empowering of communities, as well as development of information systems. So I've tried to, you know, follow this kind of thematic areas in these presentations. So with the demographic profile, Chair, you notice that, you know, as at 2019, the South African population was estimated at 58.7 million, or 58. Soon will be 60 million, with the annual birth rate that we have. Perhaps when we sit, we'll be looking at a population of 60 million in future. But it would be good to see the numbers from a perspective of the breakdown in terms of race as well as gender, so that we can understand how best we structure our interventions and how well we respond. But I just wanted to show that just between Gauteng and KZN, you know, they account for 45% of the population, two provinces. So you can imagine if health and our intervention just in those two provinces fail, it's a huge number of people that would have missed. So I thought I just wanted to show what it means when you have these numbers, but also to graphically to show you what the trends have been going back from 2002 to 2019, what the patterns have been and grown, as well as the those projections over the number of years. So why I did that is because we have to understand within the context of our health status. Every time we give you figures, you will reflect again on those population figures in provinces. So the good news, of course, is that life expectancy has been increasing in the country. And if you go back to 2002, there was a significant dip in the period of 2004 to 2009. And with the interventions from then, you know, we saw an increase. And it was largely, I mean, we can attribute this to the HIV/AIDS program, in that it has really, really extended lives and improve the quality of life of a number of South Africans. And just looking at that, you see, we still have problems, of course, with males who are, you know, sitting at chapels in the country to move. Yes. Okay. But I'll show that in the next slide. But females seem to be living much longer. Males are 61, females 65. But overall, it's about 64. But if you look at the breakdown per province, you'll realize that the province with the highest life expectancy is Western Cape at 72, followed by Gauteng at 69.8. And the lowest, actually, is Free State at 61.5. But if you look at the social determinants of health, you'll actually see the correlation between Free State and these numbers. Because a number of areas on the social determinants of health and access to services, they are the weakest, actually, in Free State. And there probably is a relationship. We have to establish that. If you look at maternal mortality, it is actually, our target was actually that it would be at 100, but we, per 100,000 live births, and it's now sitting at 134, and we're hoping that in 2024, it would be far less than that, but it would require some aggressive intervention from our side. Where we've made significant improvements is with regard to PMTCT. We've reduced maternal to child transmission significantly. If you look in 2009, it was sitting at 10.3, and now we're below 1. We're sitting at 0.65, and our target is to even reach 0, if possible. And there are provinces that are performing significantly high, you know, such as KZN. Given that it has the highest burden, it's done very well when it comes to reduction of maternal to child transmission. With under 5 mortality, we just used one slide for all three, under 5 mortality in infant mortality rate as well as neonatal mortality rate. You'll see a downward trend with regard to under 5 as well as infant mortality, but neonatal mortality rates are stubborn. They are sitting at 12, and because if you link that to maternal mortality, you'll see it's difficult to reduce those, and we have to confront both maternal mortality and neonatal mortality rates. So the other area is on nutritional status of children. It's an area that I think we need to take special interest in. Our South African Demographic Health Survey data in 2003 actually showed that stunting was 87%, wasting 5, and underweight 12. You'll realize that stunting has not changed. So it should actually be of concern because, you know, over 10 years, nothing has changed, and it has much broader implications for, you know, whether performance is not necessarily cognitive, but just in physical sports and other areas. It's an area where we should really take interest. But for wasting, you can see there's a downward trend as well as the underweight. With burden of disease, I'd like us also to look at burden of disease also relative to risk factors. I've raised the issue of social determinants of health because they have, like I said, if you look at Free State, you look at how performance has been in Free State, and you link it to social determinants of health, you'll see that it's not just the health sector response, it's a government-wide response that is needed. And in this particular area, I've just listed a few, you know, unemployment, you know, population with access to schooling, formal dwellings, those with access to sanitation, piped water, and so on, and quality of water, because those have implications broadly to other disease areas. So it cannot just be about the number of pills that people swallow.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about their well-being and other factors that affect their health. So with HIV/AIDS, this is, like I said, an area where there's been a reduction in incidence, with an actually major decline of about 49% that has been shown among females. Our worry is that even though we've shown a decrease in incidence for males, it's been a concern because the downward trend is not significant. So we probably need to look at what other interventions we need. And I've said it, and I'll say it again. When you visit our clinics, you'll see very few males, if any, in our clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Because the perception, and we probably need an MRC to do a study and establish perhaps what the health-seeking behaviors are, whether it's because of unintended consequences of our policy. You know, when you say free health care for women and children, whether they understand it to mean that it exists, maybe it doesn't, but they don't attend clinics. So our fear is that by the time they present, it's already in hospital, they're either too sick or it's for, you know, trauma and other related kind, you know, accidents and so on. But it would be good to encourage them to also access services in primary health care, because if primary health care is the main, you know, it's the backbone of our health services, and they do not access care. So I'm raising it because it's probably something that require attention. With TB, you'll see there's been a treatment success rate, but we've not met our target. We've put our target for 2019 to be 85, and we probably were not doing as well as we should. And for loss to follow up, it's a very worrying trend. I mean, Western Cape has a very significantly high loss to follow up. And it would be good to understand whether it's because of migration, is it just people who don't go back, you know, to get their medicine. And if you look, the lowest is Limpopo, sitting at 5.7. We'd really like to have a figure of less than 5% of loss to follow up. So this is an area that requires further attention. But the death rate should equally be less than 5%. And in this particular respect, you'll see that the TB death rates in Western Cape are sitting at 3.9%, which is less than the target of 5%, which is what we want. We want less people dying of TB. And our highest rates are actually in Free State. And, you know, TB is not just a medical problem, it's also a social problem. And it's social issues that you need to confront and deal with. And malaria, you'll see we're doing very well with malaria. And, in fact, bad performance in 2000. And we had interventions, particularly with the residual sprays that were used, in particular DDT. And in 2008, we had actually dropped significantly below 10,000. We even got an award as a country as a result of that. But 2017, there's a spike there, and it's not an aberration, it's real, because in Limpopo in particular, we're beginning to see malaria cases in Sekhukhune, in areas that were not formerly known to be endemic areas. So we've been working with NICD and a few of our experts in the country to to respond to this, because we are one of the 8 countries that have been selected by the World Health Organization to be elimination country, meaning we should be eliminating malaria. So with these are countries that are called E8 countries, elimination countries. And we lost this elimination status in 2017, so it has been extended to 2023. But we are back on track because Treasury made funding available for training and so on, particularly for those provinces that are along the border. KZN has been doing extremely well, as well as in Mpumalanga. The problem has been largely in Limpopo, but I think we're making headway now in Limpopo. So there are other causes of mortality, and I just wanted to reflect a bit with compliments from both SSA and MRC about the colliding epidemics of communicable and non-communicable diseases. We realized that in 1997, our communicable diseases were low, and as a result of HIV and AIDS, there was a spike, they increased. Now with the interventions, you'll see a downward trend. We're probably around maybe the same place as we were about, like in 1997. We're sitting at 29.7, and now we're around 30, 31. So at least that has sort of helped whatever interventions. But our non-communicable diseases are going up. As you see, we're sitting at 57.4. And if you look at the data from the work that was done by MRC with the breakdown according to gender, you'll see that with cardiovascular diseases, they are going down for both males and females, and as well as the it's both cardiovascular diseases, but our cancers seem to be more or less the same. But cardiovascular diseases and chronic respiratory diseases seem to be going down. The concern, I think, that I have is on diabetes, which is in both instances showing that there's a slight increase. It would be good to understand what is a contributory factor to the downward trend, particularly for cardiovascular diseases. You know, is it, and as well as respiratory diseases, is it our tobacco, our interventions with regard to the risk factors, what could it be? But also with cancer, we did an audit regarding cancer, and these are the facilities that we've identified, and we'll show you the number of patients who must access radiation oncology, and in particular, there's been an increase in demand over a 3-year period from 2013 to 2015, and we've given a list of some of the facilities where people actually should be accessing care. But we've also shown from our audit over 3-year periods what the trends have been as well in terms of absolute numbers. You'll see they've increased in 2013 to about 156,000, and in 2015 there were 214,000, and I think this number has been going up. Like I said, the risk factors that contribute to our non-communicable diseases, the graph that I showed where we have colliding epidemics, one of them is obesity, and as well as overweight people in the country. And you'll see with a breakdown per province, as well as women and men, we've got more obese females, including myself, in this country. And with regard to the other risk factors, tobacco seems to be a problem amongst men than women. Binge drinking, again, men seems to to drink more, smoke more than females. Like I said, with obesity, it's more amongst women, and even severe obesity amongst women. Hypertension seems more or less to be slightly more in women, and diabetes is our problem, and as well as anemia, but with anemia it's understood, given the women's other physiological makeup and needs. Again, if you look at the tobacco use amongst women as well as alcohol, you'll see the trends. When we did the South African Demographic Health Survey in 1998 and the one that followed, our intervention on tobacco seems to have worked, because in 1998 we were sitting at 11% for women, and it has gone down to 8%, and amongst men it has also gone down, but alcohol seems to be a problem. Nothing changed. In fact, amongst men, it seems to be going up. So this is where we surely need to intervene, because it's not only alcohol, it's other substances of abuse. So it's not only adults that we should be worried about in terms of mortality, children as well. We've looked at what the causes are with compliments from MRC. You'll see that the main cause of death amongst under 5 was HIV. Now with our intervention, that has shown a significant drop, but there are a few other areas where we've intervened. Like for instance, I would like to highlight viral diseases. You notice that in 2010, when we introduced rotavirus, there was a significant drop. From 2010 to 12, we see there's been a reduction. But there are a few other areas where we need to continue intervening, like for instance tuberculosis and so on, where there isn't much difference, but with our interventions we can show those reductions. It's not only those areas, we also have to look at injuries, as you know. Like again, this is from MRC, we need to look at interpersonal violence. This may actually be misleading because it's data that goes as far back as 2012, so we need to update this to 2019, but historically there was a drop in interpersonal violence, but I think the numbers must have gone up, particularly in this province. Mm-hmm. And it would be good to go and look at per province what the patterns are and what the trends are. These are people who present in our facility, of course, with trauma and injury. It's not just the deaths that we count, but it's the burden on the health system of accidents, of trauma, gunshots, and so on, stabbing. So in response, you have to prepare the health system to respond to the burden of disease and this population that I referred to. And we follow the WHO health system framework, with these building blocks that look at leadership, financing, workforce, medical products and technologies, information, and the service delivery. So this presentation actually has been structured to along the lines of the framework, and it suggests that if we organize things in that way, it will deliver quality and it will ensure access. Of course, our wish is that people should have improved healthcare in a responsive manner, but that there should be financial risk protection. But the financial risk protection will be as a result of the financing model that we follow, and tomorrow we'll hear about the financing board model and NHI, but also improved efficiency. So just on governance, the governance structures that we have, and I'll talk to that later when I talk about clinic committees, which is, they're at a macro, meso, and micro level. At a macro level, it's actually the National Health Council, which is a policy-making body, but at a meso level, it's supposed to be the provincial health council, and at a micro level, we're supposed to have the district health council. But in addition, we're supposed to have consultative health forums. These are supposed to be forums where we engage different stakeholders, public, private, civil society, and labor. And they should happen at all levels. And it is not sort of an option. These are provided for in terms of the National Health Act, meaning the National Health Act envisaged that when we make policy, we'd have to engage different stakeholders. Again, at a clinic level, besides these councils and consultative forums, we're supposed to also have health committees as well as hospital boards. So I just gave examples, for instance, of the number of health committees that we have in provinces. These are the number of clinic committees per province that have been established. But I'd also like to say, what is it that we need to do to make them functional? One of the things that we suggest is that, because we've developed some guidelines, is that for them to be functional, there must be training, and there are quite a number of provinces that are leading, to be honest, in the training of these clinic committees. KZN, Gauteng, Mpumalanga have already trained a number of their committees. Eastern Cape has started with training of trainers, as well as KZN. Others are following, like Gauteng, and we'll be doing that in September and October. So the main debate, which I would like to bring to the attention of the committee, is that those who participate in clinic committees are of the view that they can't just come work and not be compensated. And there's this sort of expectation of remuneration. It's something that we avoid engaging in, because we have understood that it's a community engagement. You know, it's a relationship between the community and a facility that serves them. So we've never sort of engaged this, but we wanted to put forward sort of some ideas that if there was a way of sort of covering the cost of travel, at least for people, so that they don't have to incur those expenses, as an example. But they should not be viewed like boards, you know, ordinary boards in the corporate sector, because other people want to relate that. We must still bring a, you know, a principle of service amongst our people, so that they understand that serving in those committees is also about, you know, giving back to communities, serving our communities. But somewhere we have to also do that within reason, because they also pay from their pocket. Some community members want to participate, but they're not able to. So we must come up with a standard that can apply across board. So for human resources, Chair, we summarize what the current health sector establishment is. And if you look at the overall posts in the sector, we just categorize these, but we're not saying these are the only important professionals. It's just a summary. In total, we've got about 249,000 professionals in our sector, with about 221,000 field posts. With administrative support, we've got just over 100,000, about 108,000 personnel. This is both management and support and admin, you know, your class and others. And equally, those that are filled up, about 94,900. And this is as at May 2019. This is a moving target. People resign, others get, some retire, and so on. So this number is updated on a regular basis. So with Dr. Andrew's team, we sort of worked on a huge database and system that they are working on, and I think at a later stage we'll refer to that. We've sort of broken this down per province, and you'll see this number per province, what the state of our health employment is and health establishment. So I'll not go to the provincial figures. But I think of importance, we have the Nelson Mandela Fidel Castro Collaboration Program, and the significance of this is that because we have taken a decision, a policy decision, that you're going to prioritize primary health care, and Cuba has been known to be a success story when it comes to primary health care. So these are people who are supposed to be leading in our primary health care facility. So currently we've got 1,928 of them who are in Cuba. We have recently received about 647. Last year we received 713. And they've been allocated to these universities and we'll be deploying them to our primary health care facility. And we do have, of course, challenges, but we've got strategies to mitigate these, precisely because our training model in South Africa has been such that when our doctors qualify, they are allocated in hospitals. Now, if you have a primary healthcare model, it means you have to come up with a decentralized model where they can also practice in our community health centers as well as our clinics. Meaning they come from Cuba with a primary healthcare approach. We put them in hospitals, of course, but we need to balance the hospitals and our primary healthcare ideals and plans. So we also, as a response, I'm highlighting the Cuban program and also community health workers, precisely because we think these are going to be the game changers for primary health care and a response to our health needs. So in particular, we have about 51,000 community health care workers in our system with 1,941 outreach team leaders, meaning they need a leader that must lead them in doing their work in households. And these are the numbers that we have in a breakdown per province. CKZN has a significant number, just about 10,000 of these are employed, followed by Gauteng and Northwest. So we've, based on the vacancies, we've also looked at just having the numbers of health workers, and this is a breakdown of every single employee that is needed in the health sector, from a cleaner to a groundsman to a manager to a secretary, as to how many of these do we need and what are the costs. Because I know that there's always been, you know, we don't have people in the health sector, how will we run the health sector? We've done the costing and these are the numbers, and that's the money that we'll need for all these people that have to be employed in the health sector. And with a breakdown per province, so that you have a sense. And like I said, this is a moving target. We have to revise these figures on an annual basis so that as we plan, we can look at whether we're reaching the targets or not. But I wanted to bring to the attention of the committee that it is not just the number of people and the money. There are all these other additional costs that go with the employment conditions of the health workforce. And in most instances, we know and note the labor actions. And they're largely because of, you know, these issues that keep on coming up, whether people are paid overtime, whether their leave is kept, and what kind of commitment, the pay progression, personnel performance, appraisals, and so on. I'm raising this because in most instances, when we do an analysis of our personnel costs, we look at salary. But on annual basis, we have labor actions, and as a result, we have labor negotiations, and we only see 7%. But 7% is 7% and other related negotiated settlements And in addition, we never look at this. And I just thought I needed to reflect the debt that we are confronted with over and above the salaries and other benefits that are normally negotiated, and with a breakdown per province. And I link it to the kind of labor actions that you are normally confronted with, because the lack of payment results in labor action, and I show what kind of action that is. But that's not the only thing. It's also the RWAPs, remunerative work outside the public service. You'll see that it also drains resources, because these are people who do work outside the public service, and it has implications for services in the public sector. And we've come up with strategies to mitigate these. For instance, for the policies on remunerative work, number one, and two, policies regarding COMSERV and interns, as well as strategies to deal with those costs that are likely to end up in litigation. But also, we created an HR capacitation grant, which is meant to help us bridge the gaps, as well as come up with a human resource for health strategy. So, but the third category, I refer to the Cuban program, the community health workers. The third is about nursing. Nurses are the backbone, as you know, and South Africa will be entering a new era with regard to how nurses are trained, and we've reorganized the training program to be a three-year diploma, and these have been accredited, and we're in a process of finalizing that between ourselves and the Nursing Council, as well as the Council for Higher Education. So what it means is that all public nursing colleges will be reorganized into a single college per province with multiple campuses in districts or sub-districts. It's a very significant development, but also these have to be reorganized in such a way that this three-year program will be rendered coming 1st January 2020. So that's why I say these are three key interventions that are important. Like I said, the Cuban program, nursing, as well as community health workers, to drive our primary health care agenda. But of course, these are hiccups that are there, but we're working with the Department of Higher Education and Council for Higher Education recently agreed that by come October, the intake for the new cohort must start so that they are ready to begin in January. But also, we have to ensure that, you know, the nursing strategy that deals with other aspects of nursing is ready to be launched in October. So the Human Resource for Health strategy will be, I probably should have started with this slide, but I wanted to first start with the numbers so that you can have a sense of how many people do we need and how much will it cost, but what is the interim arrangement. And I'm presenting here that with your Cuban program, community health workers and nurses, you can actually respond to what is needed. But in addition, while dealing with the rest of the other program. So with infrastructure, we've audited all of our facilities, came up with a 10-year infrastructure plan, and there's been a team of experts appointed between Treasury and Health to come up with a financing mechanism and alternative models, and this the Minister referred to in his budget speech. So we actually have a total number of 5,033 facilities. This includes mobile clinics, fixed facilities, hospital, clinic, and this is just a breakdown for you to know that this is what I describe as the health estate. This is the health estate. So in I think in figures it's probably approximately for between 350 and 400 billion. This health estate of about 5,033 facilities. So if you look at 2010 to 2018, we've actually built a few facilities. Nothing much changed in terms of our central hospital. We still have the same number, but we added 8 new additional tertiary hospitals. We changed the status of the regional hospitals because then we demolished 2. And the district hospital, there were additional 3. So there hasn't been a significant movement over this period. But there are a few others that will be opened in the near future. But we know that this estate that I referred to has you know, the average age period is about 40 years. And this is linked to the number of people who utilize these services. And, you know, the base has actually increased, but budgets have not necessarily increased. So there's been a dip over a 3-year period, largely because of the weak economy. But our forecast actually is that we need to look at the existing facilities and replace those that need replacement, maintain those and refurbish others. And we have to also dedicate functions and powers to CEOs so that they can fix things immediately. And medical equipment, we cannot talk about brick and mortar issues without talking about equipment. And these are the problems that I enlist, particularly projects that must be allocated at provincial level, that should not be at national level, projects that should be allocated to CEOs so that we identify things that would entail quick turnaround time. Like, for instance, many facilities across the country need basic equipment, so we can't order those at national level. We can allocate those at provincial level. Some can be allocated at district level. We just have to identify, you know, what kind of delegations of functions are needed. So for the in-kind grant, these are the projects that are underway, and at these costs that are estimated. And equally, in-kind grant, we show also the kind of activities that are in each province, and we've got a total count of about 118 projects that are underway, and with most being in the Eastern Cape, about 51 of them, and Limpopo with about 22 of these projects. And these are anything from refurbishment, rollout of equipment, and installing doctor's rooms or replacement of clinics or community health centers. And this is sort of an estimate of equipment that is needed. We did this costing and looked at the numbers, and some provinces did not submit their data, but this was last year when we were looking at if we were to improve the health facilities, how much would we need and what kind of equipment would be needed. So we did a costing to say, in addition to the facilities, we also need to ensure that there's equipment and equipment that works, and these are the costs and also the number of units that are needed. And equally for medicine supply, you recall that in the plan we said that we install a SVS, which is a system that tells us whether we have medicines available in facilities or not. And if you look at the dashboard, most of the provinces, in accordance with the WHO definition of availability, are sitting at between 80 and 90%, which is the amber color. And that 80 to 90% means that there's a reasonable availability. And the green that you see, which is largely in Gauteng, KZN, Mpumalanga is in the clinics. It's mainly above 90%. So where you see red, it's below 80%. So we're working with Limpopo to deal with this. But the Limpopo problem is unique because their COE is fairly high. And because of that, we attribute it to the fact that they've got about 20 to 26%. That is spent, and I'll talk to that when I refer to that slide. So there are quite a number of challenges. They are not attributed only to the provinces. Sometimes it's because of manufacturers who can't supply because they don't have API, because of regulatory issues, batch failures, and so on. But some are because manufacturers actually hold back their supply because of non-payment of suppliers. Now, if they are not paid, they don't deliver. Sometimes it's because of facilities don't place orders on time. The problem of non-payment of suppliers actually affects access. It leads to shortages. So our proposal here is that we need a ring-fenced budget, and this came also from the Presidential Health Summit, that there must be a ring-fenced amount specifically for pharmaceuticals. Treasury took over the supply of medicines, and they've been doing tenders, and this was not well executed, and we have since had the minister request that this function must reside with health again. So the Department of Health will be coordinating these tenders, and a plan is underway to execute this. And equally, South Africa needs to increase its local manufacturing capacity. And this is precisely because there are medicines that, I call them, you know, we've got neglected tropical medicines. These are, I call it abandoned medicines. I call them abandoned because, you know, they are low cost and they do not attract a significant profit, so nobody is interested in producing them. And what we are proposing here is that as a country, when we talk about state-owned pharmaceutical manufacturing or local manufacturing, we should prioritize this because these are medicines that are known to work, but they don't make enough money for the producer. So government should prioritize them as medicines that should be produced for the country to ensure security of supply. And equally, we've shown through SDS, visibility. You can actually see which provinces order on time and which ones don't. And you track your expenditure, you do some analysis, and based on that analysis, you can also track as to which are the 20 most costly items. We do what they call ABC analysis, sometimes then analysis. Then you can see that these top 20 are the ones that consume the highest budget. And when we do those analysis, one of the things that you pick up is that you begin to see medicines that are abused, you know, where there are significant problems with your supply system. On health financing, I just thought this is a slide that members should take interest in so that when we discuss NHI tomorrow, you must begin to see how money flows actually once the budget speech has been delivered by the Minister of Finance. Now, these number of financial flows within the public sector actually show you a lot of inefficiencies because money goes this way and that way and it comes back this way. Those errors at check should tell you that this is not a very efficient system of financing health. And in this respect, we probably need to review this and reorganize the way we finance health. Now, I've not even touched the private sector. This is just on the public sector. And it's one thing that you've been arguing, that the granting system, you cannot just say you know, you've got HIV today, let's have a grant for HIV. You then create a grant. Oh, it's cancer, let's come up with another grant. So you grant according to a disease. But what it does, it actually affects the performance of the health system, because what tends to happen, if you say grant for HIV, money follows HIV. And then it's to the risk of other problems. And you realize that every time you have a grant, you have donor funding, it undermines the performance of the health system. So we would like you to reflect on this slide. If anything, please focus on how best we can make this efficient and reorganize these flows even within the health system in the public sector. So these are the health sector budget problems. You'll see that over the years that we've had some growth, and the sort of estimated actual growth per province in 2018-19 to 19-20, just sitting at about 3.3%, you know, for Eastern Cape, and now 4.7. But overall, if you look just based on total payments, it's at 7%. Now, I'm raising the 7% because, you know, one would say that, you know, health has shown growth. Health has shown growth, but what has it translated to? Our view, Chair, is that if you look at this growth alone and you don't look at other factors, it is kind of misleading. In a sense that, firstly, I said earlier that your increase, when you go for negotiations with labor, there'll be salary negotiations of 7% increase. But what you do not factor in, number one, is that in addition there's increase for medical aid contribution, which is not included in the 7%. There's allowance, danger allowance, this other allowance. And your cost may be anything between 11 and 12%. So if your growth is 7%, but your demand, which you have to absorb within this, is anything between 11 and 12%, it means over the years, there's been shrinkage. So we have to look at this growth relative to all these other demands. And you'll see where the money goes in the provinces. I just used this slide up to 18-19. In the provinces, the money goes for administration, district health services, emergency medical services, provincial, central, health services and training, support services and so on. So you need to see how financing. And Chair, I'm going back again. Look at it within the context of this slide. You've got this slide where money goes everywhere. And then internally within a province, it must be split in this manner. So you need a mechanism of bringing about efficiencies on how you allocate, but on how you organize the flow of finances internally within the public services. But if you look at the share of the provincial allocation, over, you know, 2018 and 19, I've got a green there and amber, right? And blue means it's a share of inclusive of grants, actually. So where you're seeing improvements is actually in Western Cape, Northern Cape, Limpopo, Gauteng, and Eastern Cape. Free State remain the same. It's been stable. KZN stayed the same. Mpumalanga and Northwest. At national, because your figure for 2020-2021 is 223 billion that will be allocated. That's an estimate, but the current allocation is 209 billion. So of this is just what is allocated. It excludes grants. Okay? Now, for the grants, it's actually 61 billion that is allocated to national. And from that 61 billion, I'll take you back to this slide. You've got 209 billion that follows that arrow to the left. And we've got 61 billion that goes to national, right? And from that 61 billion that takes to national, you take a proportion of that, let's say about 47 billion, you allocate it again to provinces. Okay, so you've got these two streams. Because you have a grant for HIV, you've got a grant for infrastructure, you've got a grant for this, that, or the other. So you've got that stream, and then you've got another grant that goes to local government. But you also have the provincial own revenue that also must be allocated. So I'm showing you these administrative costs in these multiple areas that you need to really pull together. So of these grants, I thought I needed to show you that, of course, some money for compensation and so on, but I was more interested to showing you what these grants go to do. These grants are for hospitals, for you know, national tertiary services, for HIV AIDS, NHI. I'm raising that chair because if you look at indirect grants, it means you've got out of the 61 billion, it's another granting mechanism for financing health. When you could just say this is for services, this is how services should be funded. The next one is direct grant. It's about, in this financial year, 44 billion, meaning from the 61 billion, you're going to remove about 54 that you'll use for grants. When you could just have put the money centrally for these services. This is for HIV, TB, community health workers, malaria, national tertiary services, training, health facility grants, HPV. I'm saying that there are actually some inefficiencies in the manner in which we finance health. But we also have, as you said, public entities, and in this financial year, it's about 1.8 billion, but they also have other mechanisms by which they can fund their activities. I raise that because as part of your health system framework, other than HR, like I showed you that HR, these are the gaps, these are the number of posts that must be filled, and this is the money that is required. You need equipment. You can't do a granting framework. You have to decide that you have a mechanism by which within your infrastructure grant you say this is equipment that's needed and this is the money. So the Kenyan model check, the way Kenya did it, they just said we'll provide equipment for the whole country. We're going to put money for 5 years, and over 5 years equipment will be available. This is the team that will maintain and we'll follow this on annual basis. So you may want to do that and reorganize the way you do it. And you can do that with infrastructure. Like the minister said, have innovative financing, where you just have one vehicle that drives the infrastructure in an innovative way. And you deliver over 5 to 7 years. You do that for infrastructure, you do that for equipment, and you also have other mechanisms. But these multiple grants for this or the other, I think, need to be reviewed, and we've raised this repeatedly with Treasurer, and I'm happy to say that at least for a change check, we're finding each other with Treasurer. There's sort of some convergence on how we can improve financing. But it's not only money that comes through the fiscal chair. We also have a donor funding, and it's quite a significant proportion of money. And I thought that we needed to present more or less how much has been flowing through our system. Anything from a Center for Disease Control, the European Union, Japanese, and so on, and USAID, and Global Fund. So I thought I needed to put the constraints at the end. Constraints that affect the health system, because I looked at the framework the first one I needed to is about the fragmented health system, distribution of the human and financial resources, because I focused on the public sector, but there's also the cost in the private sector and the problems that we've
have been reported in the health market inquiry, in particular the concentration of funders, the rising cost of out-of-pocket payment, but the consumer in South Africa that is not so informed, ineffective controls of rising volumes of care, and under-regulation. But of course the inequities are also known, and the rising burden of disease, particularly non-communicable diseases, as I showed in the earlier slide, and the fiscal constraints and shrinking budgets. And the COE, like I said, is sometimes seen as at 7.2% for an allocation, and this was for, at the time, 111 billion. But our problem is that the health sector COE increased on average about 6.6. But for your Limpopo, Northern Cape, and Northwest and Western Cape, it has been at a rate of about 6%. Now, what happens then, because of this pattern and this trend, it affects our COE, meaning as the increases are reflected, the provinces have to protect money for compensation of employees. And as they do that, it affects money for goods and services. So goods and services received an increase of about 5%, and with the inflation, when inflation is taken into account, we're looking at a budget cut in real terms, like I said earlier. So we show here just the examples of Eastern Cape and Gauteng, for instance. We've done this for every province. Is that your change in COE as well as change in goods and services, when you look at the total overall budget, that your increase in COE has actually crowded out your money for goods and services. But in particular, I wanted to show you that this is going to be worse in your 2019-2020, because in that year you'll have a 5% budget cut. Your provinces are going to have 11 billion less than they need to render services. And in the subsequent year, they're going to have 14 billion less than they need for services. So hard choices are going to be made, because those cuts are not only for them, but it's also for your entities. And I wanted to say that in addition, you have these accruals, but there's actually an improvement, because you're beginning to see a reduction in some of the accruals, particularly for the 2018-2019 period, with a lot of yellow there, as you notice, and except for two provinces, I think Eastern Cape and Gauteng are the ones that are outliers, because they're anything between 10 and 15%, but other provinces are showing a very positive trend and an improvement. The second area that I think we should take interest in is the medical legal claims. When we look at the report, given a figure of about 98 billion contingent liabilities. So what we did an analysis to look at what does this 98 billion mean, Chair. And I just wanted to say that from the analysis that we have, actually 26 billion of that is actually letters of demand. They've not been converted into litigation. Meaning out of 98 billion, 26 is a threat, it's a letter of demand. 37 billion of that is actually MVA cases that should have been referred to RAF. 37 million, not billion, sorry. 37 billion is the figures. It's what should have been referred to Road Accident Fund. It doesn't even belong to health. So from your 98 billion, you should remove those. And some cases should have been referred to Bayer. 162 million is actually prescribed. 54 million are matters that have been closed. So I've taken the 98 billion because that's a figure that is presented to us, and to say that those are not appropriate. So we did an analysis, Chair, even per province, to show you which facilities are targeted for this medical service, and per province, which district, which hospital, and what are the amounts, so that we know what we're dealing with, and we can reduce this burden. I mean, if you're going to have budget cuts, and if you have accrual, and if you have constraints, you have to look at where the leak is and see whether you want to deal with the leaks. But I think, Chair, we also wanted to know who are these lawyers and what are the amounts. The lawyers who are milking this system are here. I thought we needed to present them to you. It's actually three law firms. It's this firm, okay, but I'm just saying that it's money that we need for medicines, it's money that we need for employment of employees. So we did this analysis precisely because we need to understand this problem. But of course, this gives you the figures of how much they claimed and the number of cases, and you see the VEM renal attendance feature prominently. But Chair, we thought, because if you are going to have a budget cut, you have to reprioritize. We have reprioritized within national to say we'd like to reorganize, and this is the money that we'd like to see allocated back to provinces so that they can fill the posts, particularly where we've identified the gaps. So, Chair, I'll go to the next component of the health system.
Hold on. So sorry to interrupt, just a point of clarity. These are the attorneys claiming against the department. They're not our representative, or are they our representative?
They are claiming against.
They are claiming against us. Yes. Okay.
So Chair, on health information, leadership and governance, like I referred to earlier, that we have the number of entities that are responsible for health information systems at provincial and national level. At national level, the Ministerial Advisory Committee, we've got National Health Information Systems Committee, but the provinces themselves can also appoint the Provincial Health Information Systems Committee, and these are appointed by the MECs under the National Health Act. And for this reason, we've come up with these strategies. And I just wanted to mention that these are the systems that we have that are supposed to give us health information for purposes of planning, but also management decisions. Others are actually patient information systems for clinical decision making. And these are the systems that we have in place. We even give you, you know, the footprints, where they are, where they've been installed, which ones are working, and how many people are on the system. We've captured about 43 million individuals on these systems. And for other dispensing systems, we've got about 2.5 million people. But we have SDS, the self-disability, which I referred to earlier. We've got a system to track community health workers, systems to track pregnant women who visit our facilities and who send us messages if they're unhappy with their services. And for Mom Connect, I think we now have about 2.7 million women that we've been tracking who've registered on the system. But it's not only that. We've also used mHealth for our clinicians. You know, the Road to Health card that mothers used to use, they can now get this on an app. We have similarly our guidelines, the HIV clinical guidelines, the essential medicine, TB clinical guidelines on the app, the doctors can access them. So Chair, we try to make these tools available, and you can, even as the members of the committee, access these and look at them. But we've developed standards, and I raise the standards because we had historically spent a lot of money on information systems, particularly at provincial level. And these are standards that should guide where investments should be made when we buy systems. And when we assess our systems, Chair, against the standards, these are all the systems that are available that are being used. And we checked assessment as to a primary care level, you know, what the functionality of these systems are, what features they have, but also whether they are compliant with our standards. We also looked at the cost of these systems, and they range anything from 200,000 to 1.4 billion. And you know, it's interesting to have that kind of price range between the systems that are installed. And we wanted some form of standardization whereby we can say these are the standards that should comply, should be complied with, and for which a performance can be measured. We've done a similar exercise for the hospitals, and I apologize for the small print. And these are all the systems that have been installed in our hospitals, and we've done more or less a similar exercise, and about 23 out of 28 are systems that comply. And you'll see that in terms of compliance with regard to performance. This is the status in terms of those systems. And so just a summary, with respect to functionality, more than half the systems scored higher than 80%, meaning we should actually keep those systems. We don't have to go on tender again, buy new systems. We must use money and maintain them and make sure that they work. In terms of compliance with the you know, the norms and standards that we've developed, more than 70% scored below 50. Those are the systems that we have to review, establish whether we want to continue keeping or whether we want to review them. Because as we prepare for NHR, we have to really look at the performance of these systems. So why I presented this is because we need an electronic health record. And as we move towards an electronic health record, you need a sort of a backbone that you should put in place, and our health patient registration system is that backbone, because it must serve as a master patient index that will link, and sort of other systems should hook onto this. And we've started with that, Chair. As you notice, we have this breakdown per province. I didn't want to, you know, have many slides. This is a summary slide that shows you out of the population of 58 million, we've been able to register almost 43 million of them, and that we still have about 9.9 million that we must verify, and we've installed the system of out of a total of 3,500 facilities. We've installed the system in 3,000 facilities. We still have about 460 more facilities that are without the system, and we have 20,000 computers installed in all these facilities in our provinces, and we still have to deliver about 940. We've also installed Wi-Fi in all these facilities so that they can download reports, and particularly for our district health information system. So as we move towards the electronic health record, it will help. I'm raising that because it's going to be important for our organized services in the health system. Communication between your clinics and your hospitals, your emergency medical services, you need a functional information system. For primary health care, these are the services that are organized from community-based community health workers to clinical diagnostic and emergency services, as well as some of the support services. And I just showed sort of how these levels are organized, but in particular, I just put this slide about IGIL because we want to improve the quality of services in our facilities. And this slide shows the performance per province of our facilities. We still have four provinces that are lagging behind with regard to IGIL clinic status. Northern Cape has significantly improved, as you noticed, and Gauteng is doing fairly well. So we also render these services. I just picked a few, not all of them. For instance, school health services, because we're reporting on these. The first is about the HPV services. The second one is all other services about screening learners for various conditions. But I wanted to highlight overweight and underweight, because remember in our data, I referred to stunting, I referred to obesity. It's probably one area that requires attention, and we can start when learners are still young, but we assess a whole lot of learners, even for reproductive health. Antenatal care, you see that on average, there are provinces that are doing well, particularly KZN, Mpumalanga, and Northwest, with regard to delivery in our facilities. There are a few provinces that are below the national average. In particular, Gauteng is not doing so well, and we'll be working with the Gauteng. Immunization under one coverage, Limpopo, Northwest, Free State, Eastern Cape are not performing as well as they should. In fact, most provinces are below average except Northern Cape, Mpumalanga, and KZN. So our reference system, I thought I needed to refer to our policy. We just finalized our reference policy to ensure that people can get optimal care, better coordination. And this referral must also be linked to our information system. These are our referral flows in our facilities between community service areas with our outreach programs led by community health workers and their outreach leaders, as well as our clinics, community health centers, and different levels of hospitals. So for emergency, these are the package of services that we have for emergency medical services. And currently we've got 6 operating as provincial services, which is KZN, Western Cape, Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, Limpopo, and Mpumalanga. This is based on the new regulations that we've passed. And those that are combined, provincial and local government, and housing provinces. So the reason is I'm raising this is because there's always this concern about people not being picked up by ambulances. So you have to know who is responsible. Is it the provincial competence or is it a local government competence? Two decentralized district level are those services that are rendered in Northwest and Free State. And there are more than 5,000 emergency medical vehicles in the country. And of these 2,900 are ambulances. Others are planned patient transport services. And there are about 16,000 emergency medical personnel and about 9 EMS colleges in the country. So far we need to implement a 112. This matter keeps on being referred to in Parliament so that we have one number for the country, and standardize the corporate grant and also finalization of the regulations. We need one country, one health, but not one EMS. Now, one country, one health, but not one EMS results in inconsistent provision. That's why we need that one number. About 30% of ambulances, ambulance fleet that are not functional, and that have actually done 313 of them have done over 300,000 kilometers. So it means they should not be on the road, and we have to make sure that those are removed. And for patient-centered care, we conduct these services to check whether people are happy with the services. You see that our overall patient satisfaction is at 75%. In OPD, it's 72%. 73 inpatient, 72. The reason we conduct these services is it's an indicator of whether people are happy and whether the quality of care that we render is appropriate. So we have to ensure that on an ongoing basis we conduct these surveys. And these are the findings from our surveys. What is it that people are not happy about? They're unable to access care, or some of them, they have waited too long. I think this one of waiting too long is a common occurrence. Some are not happy with the sendiness. Others say that they were treated in the private sector, and that, you know, stuff with the attitude were good, and some received advisory visits, others didn't. But there were also findings for our hospital in that access was about 72.6% and availability of medicines. I've presented the slide. You know, it differs from province to province. As you noted, Limpopo was not the best performer. Cleanliness was also not so good. It's about 72% and attitude 70. And waiting time is a big problem for even. So gender, we thought we needed to conclude in Women's Month with this slide to say whether the services that we render are responsive. We started this She Conquers as an evidence-based campaign for South African youth, and particularly young women, to reduce infections, to deal with teenage pregnancy, but also ensure that gender-based violence interventions and girls' education, and promote HIV testing and counseling activities, sexual and reproductive health rights for girls, and we have that policy and dual protection and exclusive breastfeeding. We've been promoting that, and we've come up with that app for road map to nutrition and road to health chat. And Mom Connect, we've also come up with movie sites for young people and termination of pregnancy choice for young women and also older, and reduction of mother to child. We've got guidelines on rape, sexual assault, and related sexual crime, and accelerated a campaign to reduce maternal and child mortality as part of our AU initiative, and our policy on contraception and fertility. And this is our conclusion. Thank you, Chair.
Now you can drink your water. Done very well. Colleagues, there are two other supporting documents here. I've scanned through the other one. It's giving details of something we're going to hear, because he has given highlights of the entities and starts by saying what is MRC, what are they doing. I was going to really suggest that we take that as a preparatory document for our meetings that we are going to have with the entities, and take this one comprehensive one to be the main document that I would like you to interrogate with. So as you know, because when I come by you and your hand is not up, I assume you are not having your hand up. Now, I would like members of the DG's going to decide who will help her to answer, but I would like members to really go through this, ask questions, clarify questions, comments that will enrich our discussion. I think it has been extremely helpful to listen to this presentation. Long as it was up to the last slide, it was still interesting to listen to it. So let me then start in the front row and look for members who are going to give one to comment. That Honorable Wilson, you are number one, keep your number. Sukes, you are number two. Chira, you are number three. Now I'm going to the back row. Kela, you are number four. Sukes, you are number five. Bahube, you are number six. Mamu Susan, you are number seven. Stalin, you are number eight. So I will be number nine. Okay, in that order, colleagues.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for quite a comprehensive report. It's hard to, I have a lot of questions, despite your comprehensive report, but I'm going to just do a couple, but it's one of the better, more comprehensive reports we've seen in a long time, and I think it has given a few new perspectives, both what's happening provincially and how that's affecting nationally. But I do have a few questions, and my first one is the increase in cancer patients requiring care. And I raise this particularly because in our last report from Limpopo, we were advised that the waiting time from diagnosis to oncology in Limpopo was 12 months, which is principally a death sentence. And in your discussion, and you talked about dealing with the population, I think this is possibly sometimes where we're missing the bus. We are dealing with a population of 60 million South Africans. We're actually not. We are dealing with a population of over 80 million in this country. Because if you take into account the foreign nationals and the undocumented nationals, they are close on 20 million at the moment. So we cannot use it, and we have to service people who are ill. We're obliged. If people are ill, they must be serviced. They must be treated in this country. So it is a concern that we're dealing, putting budgets in terms of perspective of South African population, when in actual fact we're 20 million off the mark. And I think this is where a lot of our problems are raised, and I think this is what's having an impact, a huge impact. I've recently visited hospitals in Hammanskraal, Bella Bella, you know, on the borders of Limpopo. We not only are, as one hospital, trying to deal with four provinces, a huge amount, and particularly in Limpopo, a huge amount of their patients are foreign nationals who are undocumented. And budgets don't cater for this. Because already you've said here, this is what we're catering for. We're catering for 60 million people. We're not. We're actually catering. We should be catering for 80, and I think this is having a huge impact on the budget. And I'd like your comments on that, because I think we're missing the bus there totally. One of the other issues I wanted to raise was on the appointment of clinic committees. I was a ward councillor myself before I came to Parliament. I sat on both my hospital clinics board and committee and the clinics committee. And I think one of the things, that, again, where we are missing the bus is how we elect those committees. And I know that when I had the clinic in my ward and we had our election, political parties were sending representatives to stand on those committees who were quite clearly people who did not live in the ward or had a connection to that ward. In fact, they were coming from 20 or 30 kilometers away. Something you discover after the fact. So I hear what you're saying in terms of remuneration and travel and everything, but if we were appointing our committees correctly, and if we had more clarification about who and where that committee should come from, a lot of those problems would be alleviated. And I think that's something that we have to seriously assess. You made a comment about primary health care. I was part of the delegation that went to Cuba last year. Their primary health care is truly quite phenomenal. But they've got an 11 million population to our 80 million, which makes things a little bit more challenging here. But you talked about the Cuban doctors coming back and being placed in the primary health care. Wonderful. Great. But it's the one budget that's been cut. So the decision to do one thing and the decision to cut the budget don't go hand in hand. It doesn't make sense. You mentioned the situation with slide 67 of the province delegating to CEOs certain tasks like infrastructure. And in recent visits to the hospitals, this has become a huge issue. And it's not just infrastructure, it's vacancies. It's ordering of certain things. And I'll give you an example that we faced at the Bella Bella Hospital. Two examples. One was the contract for the people who did the cooking in the hospital, for the kitchen. Okay. One contract had expired. They were in the process of trying to get the second one, but before they could do that, it had to go from this hospital to the district, from the district to the province, to get approval from the province that came back to the district that then came back to the hospital. 5 months down the line, process is not finalized, and the nurses and dietitians are cooking for an entire hospital because there's no contract in place for the kids and the people who do the cooking in the hospital. Now, those nurses are coming, and I witnessed it, off duty on a weekend, and out of care and compassion for the patients, are not taking the time off that they could see me. They're all standing in the kitchens cooking. So it's not just infrastructure. This process, you talked about your cash flow process and your decision-making process, has seriously hindered the CEOs of the hospital, and I do believe that this is something we need to address urgently. And in closing, Chair, sorry, and I've got so many, but I'll just do these. It's interesting to see what lawyers are suing the department for in terms of malpractice claims. What is not in your presentation is what we've spent defending those claims, and I think I'm actually probably a bit too scared to ask for a real figure. And finally, your EMS services, and you talked about the changing in policy and the bills about who qualifies to be an EMS. We have people losing their lives on the road as a change of that policy where they now have to have had that four years degree to qualify as a full-blown EMS. We've got EMS personnel out there, and not one, hundreds, who have been EMS personnel for up to 20 years. They have gone through all the courses. They started at your whatever your first level was, and over the years they have built up and have extensive training and have saved thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. They have now been stopped on the roadside treating severely, severely injured patients and saving lives because of the change in this policy. They're not allowed to intubate. There's certain procedures because they haven't had that four-year degree, diploma, whatever the thing says, because they haven't done that. They've now been stopped from operating. And as a result of this, we have a lot of EMS personnel walking away because of the frustration of being unable to save a life on the side of the road when they know they can and they're not allowed to. And I really think that this needs to be looked at. We had one this last weekend. That life would have been saved had they been able to intubate and do the basic life-saving things. It was an EMS who has been doing this for 30 years. 30 years he's been saving lives. He's now been told he's not allowed to. I think this is a serious, serious matter, and I think we need to address it. Thank you very much.
Honourable Wilson, you must not hold yourself back, because this is the only time we are going to have the department understanding everything else. And next time we meet them, it will be a specific issue. So let's use this time, because while we break for lunch, we'll still be allowed to come back and continue. The department is here. We'll still be joining the minister tomorrow, so they are not rushing back to Pretoria. We are also not rushing to go and sleep. So let us ask as many questions as we can. Now, number two.
Thank you, Chair. I firstly want to thank the DG for a very comprehensive presentation, and especially for the mother-to-child transmission. I think it is phenomenal, the reduction in infection. It is phenomenal, really. As well as with HIV/AIDS, we're not where we want to be, but the department has done phenomenal work in terms of treatment with that. My question, primary question, two of the questions my colleague has already asked, I'm going to add to the one on the current claims against the department. My question really is, what are the risk mitigation that the department is implementing in order to reduce that? And part of that risk mitigation, how much of arbitration can the department do preemptively before patients go towards, are there almost customer what can I call it, a tracking where you can track that this can possibly lead to bigger cases. Because in most of our hospitals, there are no systems where patients can provide feedback. And many times, patients do not even know that they have the right to call on administrators to intervene in cases where they are not happy with the service that they receive. And this can actually also be part of the technology advances that the department is making, technological advances. Then in terms of the public sector system, I just want to know whether the department is reorganizing or restructuring the public sector system. Is this going to form part of the NHI rollout, or is it going to be, is there an analysis before that? Before we go into that, is there an analysis that is going to be done by the department? I think that is it for me now, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, DG, for the presentation. Shout out to you. I have a few questions here. I think most of them are clarity-seeking questions. I'm going to try to group them properly. On non-communicable diseases, deaths increasing, I wanted to find out what are the contributing factors, yeah, especially with diabetes, and I wanted to know the link in different provinces. Because there's an instance in Creole, in Mpumalanga, I'm sure you know, which is the SO2, pollutant, whatnot, is the highest, is the second highest in the world, and it contributes to diabetes and other respiratory infections. And if there are preventative measures in like high risk areas with mines that does cooling and all of that, because then they become high risk areas for such diseases. And secondly, what informs the allocation of staffing resources to different provinces? Because I'm noting that in the Free State, with nursing and equipment, the shortage is significantly high. And I want to know what would inform that Free State is neglected, if I may, for lack of a better word. In fact, yeah. Neglected is the right word. What are the reasons behind that? And also the data on medicine shortages in provinces, it wasn't specified. So we know which is this province is like this, this province is like that. And the last one, the decline of male HIV infections, is it a true determination that's noted here if we're having a problem with testing of males, and what is the impact of that then on this issue? Thank you.
Oopsie. I want all the colleagues on the back row just go down this way.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also join my other colleagues by welcoming the report, the presentation. Indeed, it is a comprehensive report, and we really appreciate that, DG. Especially, this is the end of Women's Month. We really appreciate that. Imbobodo. The other, I'm on slide 114. If we can just increase the font, because really we can't see it. The list of hospital patient information system is so that we have information. The other one is about the public health facilities under mobile services. And I can see the Gauteng It's nothing under mobile services. If I can just get the clarity whether you didn't get information or what, because I'm from that space and I was in health department at local level as LMC for health, but I know that there's a need for mobile clinic in the rural areas because we do have rural area in Gauteng. The other one, the challenge, but we need to resolve it, Chair. It's a burning issue. As I'm saying, I'm from local level. I know the challenges that we faced. We faced actually because I was part of it by then. The issue of clinic committee, I was partly covered by the MP there, but I think we need to do something. I'm not saying we must pay stipend, but I think the department must also do something, because when you check the CHWs, they get something, and other volunteers, they get something within the department itself of health. And when it comes to the clinic committee, it's nothing. And most of the time, they are there. When you call a clinic committee meeting, they do attend those meetings. But the challenge that they keep on raising, can't we get at least for transport or for something? Because sometimes, in other words, the clinic is in the center area and it covers four, three wards within the space. So you can't say when you advertise for clinic committee, only people who are closer to the clinic or only that ward, because that clinic is servicing all people who are residing in that area. So it's something that you must also look into it. But also, there was a model that was used in Gauteng in the last election of clinic committee. It was the involvement. There was a notice, and there was also involvement of ward councillors. There was a public participation where it was allowing anyone who is interested to be a clinic committee to apply. So if also we can use that model so that at least everything is transparent to all provinces. But it's something that people, they do voluntarily. Sometimes we thought, if we can get maybe pensioners like nurses or teachers who can volunteer to do that work, but it's very difficult because other people, they are not committed to volunteer for to do a volunteerism in the clinic. But those who are interested, I think, because it's also go with a passion of something that you like. So I don't know, but that will be my request, Chair. Maybe a discussion for another platform, in another platform, so that at least if they can just get something. Like, for instance, even the ward committee now, in other places, they get 500 rand per month. Do you see? So when you compare to health, it's something that frustrates you. So I don't know, but let the department work on it so that at least we address the challenge that we have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also join the committee members to welcome the nicely drafted report by the DG and team. I won't have questions, Chair, just points of clarity. First one is under the Nelson Mandela Fidel Castro Collaboration Program, a very good program, and which trained our students from South Africa in a more in line with what we need in South Africa, particularly on primary healthcare sector. The teacher has given us the number of students that are in Cuba and the number of them that have arrived back in South Africa. She has given us the challenges, which is understandable. But what I like, she also mentioned what plans are in place. One of them, to make sure that all provinces come on board in terms of the linkage with medical schools and assist those provinces that have a burden on financial resources, which is very great. I'm sure provinces like the Northern Cape will also benefit. But she has mentioned Mpumalanga and so on, which is a great thing. My question then of clarity, Chair, is when these students will be deployed to primary health care sectors, will all provinces benefit? I know the province like the Northern Cape usually suffers a lot, and we've got very vast areas, clinics that are far from, you know, the main centers. What formula will be used to make sure that these students are deployed equally throughout the provinces? And then under the nursing achievements, very good, DG. I like the way the department is trying to standardize the training of nursing. Like you said, that there's all public nursing colleges were reorganized into a single college per province with multiple campuses in districts, which is a very good thing to make sure that we make sure that this mass rooming of illegal nursing colleges doesn't go on. Then the last point of clarity is around the emergency medical services. DG said that there are 9 provincial EMS colleges, of which one is not accredited. Just for information, which one, where in which province is this one emergency a college that is not accredited? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to try and group my questions so that they are just easier to understand. So I've got 3 questions and 1 around the health financing. The 3 questions are, I wanted to just find out, I mean, you speak about, DG, about the process of reorientating students from the Cuban doctor program back into the country, especially to try and place them. So I just want to find out, you know, what is the cost of this reorientation exercise? How long does it take? And what is the feasibility in terms of financing of perhaps looking into training people, especially when it comes to primary health care locally? Has a feasibility study been done in terms of whether or not it is more cost effective to train people locally than it is to train them in Cuba? As I know, the program has been going on for some time, but obviously as finances are a problem, has the department looked at this? And so what is the outcome of that feasibility sort of exercise? Then the other issue is, I know that this is obviously a big problem with you and the Department of Higher Education, but I'm made aware that they has been a delay in the accreditation of certain institutions around, especially for nursing. And so what is the envisioned impact of this for the cohort of nurses for 2020? Is it going to have an impact in terms of how many nurses we're able to train and how many nurses we're able to place? And also what has been sort of the status with that, because you do name it as one of the challenges in your presentation. Then the second last question is around the national guidelines on rape and sexual assault. What work has been done between you and SAPS in terms of this? It's all good and well to obviously have guidelines, but if they're not being followed in police stations, if they're not being necessarily implemented, they can only just exist in documents. So, what have been the sort of collaboration efforts between you and SAPS and Social Dev, if there is a connection there on how to implement these guidelines, and how are you guys monitoring that they in fact are being implemented when women are reporting these issues in police stations? Then the last question is around the issue of financing. So there was a very useful slide that you showed us around how money flows from Nash Department and how it's allocated. So that's the one point to take note. And then the second point is you talk about how the department aims to start to delegate, especially functions, to CEOs to be able to procure certain things at a local level to speed up that kind of delivery. But how are these two sort of functions aligning with the intentions of the National Health Insurance to centralize procurement? There seems to be some kind of misalignment, and I mean, you can correct me here, but there seems to be some kind of misalignment between your plans to decentralize procurement to a local level or at least a regional level. But at the same time, as we know, the draft legislation before this committee seeks to centralize procurement at a national level. So so how is there going to be a shift that will be made? You know, at what point? And how does this align? That's me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just would like to start with the information on page 2 with reference to the background information that was given, where mention was made that we can have the evaluation of the implementation of National Health Insurance Phase 1 inclusive of the appraisal report. Can we please, if it's possible, have that information, because I believe in that information more questions that are asked by the various stakeholders about the NHI implementation thereof can maybe be answered. Number two, if you go to page 21, the summarized on human resource of health workforce, the summarized version of the public health sector establishment, there is a high percentage of vacancies that exist, even as we speak, according to this report. We are talking about the possible implementation of NHI, but at the same time, there exist some vacancies. My question is, how do you, how will you be able to can fill up these vacancies, especially because it involves specialists, it's about nursing categories, it's about registrars, medical practitioners, it's about and other related professionals. Are we not adding a problem on top of the existing problems as they are not solved at this moment? And at the same time, it's also inclusive of administrative and support services. We definitely would need the administrative part of NHI not to go wrong, but we have problems here, experience of vacancies that are existing. How will we be able to can solve the problem of administration, inclusive of the managerial aspects of the project itself? Or can't we go back and solve these problems first before we start with something that is so big? On page 32, that deals with page 32, refurbishment, page 32, the last bullet there. The experts have been given a clear directive to accelerate the refurbishment of all old hospitals, and I assume it's all clinics. What I want to make the DG aware is the fact that what has been said, we are going to use this as the Bible for 5 years. We are going to use it. As the province will be coming to present the what is happening in health in their provinces, we will judge their own presentation with this Bible of today. So if we say all hospitals and all clinics Is it possible for that to happen within 5 years and 7 years? Something that never happened in the past parliament. So what I would like to know is, we don't have to talk of all. We have to have a list of all those against the hospitals that are old according to the identification of the provincial leadership. And the same applies to the clinics, which I think it will also be a problem. So I just would like to, maybe it's a fault to say all hospitals and all things, but it has been mentioned and it's appearing here in the official document on page 32. Page 59, I'm just finishing. On page 59, there's a new, let me just go there, 59, and then we talk about moving to an electronic health record. Yes, it's a statement, and it's been given to us. But the reality of the matter is, we have clinics that do not have electricity. How are we going to make those clinics move towards this electronic health record? How is it possible to have such a thing happening? So it's a problem in a lot of clinics. And the same applies to the installation of Wi-Fi and its contradictory statements there. But like I said, we'll be able to judge what has been sent here with the what the provinces will be presenting to us during the course of these 5 years. And lastly, I just want to make a comment on patients' experience, as it's reflected, I think, towards the end. And my question is, the survey was conducted in primary health care and as it is stated then, in the hospitals. My question is, I don't know who the respondents to this survey are and where their situation and which hospitals is referred to. But there are more problems in hospitals and clinics, rather than just a mere success into the researches as it has been conducted. I can just refer to one example that I definitely know about, and I presented one patient who was injected wrongly. She was injected wrongly, and then she lost the use of that arm. And the problem was presented to those who were supposed to hear that problem. But today, not even a single one of them has taken just one moment to call that patient to find out what happened from the national, provincial, to the district. And then we talk about the healthy national health department. It should be a healthy national department that cares about the patients in South Africa. So in future, we don't have got to give a statement from the positive side of views. We have to weigh all the pros and cons, the negatives and the positives, so that we all together move towards the building of a proper health department in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I see this 5 minutes before one, but I'll keep you busy for half past. No, not really. I have a few questions, and maybe I can get some help understanding. Page 19, slide 38. I just want to know if the department can tell me how many of these clinic committees is active per province, if we have it figured. And then I
Yes. Yeah.
How many of the clinical committees is active per province? Then overall on page 24 to 25, I just want to try to understand is why do we have South Africa have a shortage of doctors and nurses in state hospitals? And I try to understand why the training of new doctors must be done in Cuba. I try to put the role of Cuba versus our own universities in South Africa. So I try to put that together. If I can just be able to try to understand that. Then on page 26, slide 52, why don't we pay our employees? What is the reason for this debt we have? If you see the compensation of employees is one of the reasons, the very top one, in the 2018-19 financial year. Why did this happen, and what was the reason for that? On page 34, just slide 68, the medical equipment and machinery. This is a very big problem in all our hospitals, and all the hospitals I've visited in Gauteng and the rest of the country, it's actually a disgrace to see this type of things. But I want to know what plans have the department in place to give serious attention to this problem, and what turnaround strategy is in place to overcome this problem, and over what period. If we go to page 38, slide 75, about the provincial accounts placed on hold due to overdue accounts. I just want to know who's the provinces, who's involved in here, for how long, and what amounts are outstanding to these overdue accounts, and what is the reasons for that. I know this is a long question, but maybe we can get some answers on that. And then on page 57, slide 113, I just want to know, is this private contractors, which is contracted by the department, and if it is, why don't the department have its own IT department? If we do have, initiate your own IT department, will this not save money at the end of the day? And how many contractors, if it's outside contractors, are involved in this project? And then on page 68, slide 136, I just want to know how many of these 5,000 emergency services vehicles are operational countrywide. And then the very last question, on page 69, slide 137, it states we had more than 30% of ambulance fleets non-functional. I just want to know what the reason is for this. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Chair, I forgot one other question.
Thank you so much, Chair. It's on the page 58, slide 116, on the summary of patient information systems. You say that, well, it's written that 80% of these systems are, like, function on 80%, no? And I think they are supposed to because, it's not, they are not free. And the prices are here on 57, on slide 113. And it's a lot of money. And my concern is that 70% of these systems, yeah, tested scored below 50% on the health normative standards framework. And then I think what comes up next is that why then are we using this? Because you also made a comment that then we don't need to get new ones or release new tenders or whatnot. Then why are we using them? I mean, if their outcome is not based on what we want them to perform on, and we place their success on them just working, it's like, it doesn't make sense because the health normative standards framework here is very important because it talks to identifiers, messaging, content and structure, continuity of care under content and structure, and coding and terminology, general IT security. So now if those standards, if 70% of these systems that we pay for score less than 50%, what then becomes their need, and how do we solve the fact that 70% of these score below 50, and because we haven't tested all of them, I saw we tested 23 of 28. 23 complied, but then the ones tested are also 23. So if, are we going to test all of them, the whole 28, and of the 28, then, you know, I just want to know what then becomes the need of these systems if they don't work to function for the standard that we want them to function on, and the fact that they are working on, just to say, this pen can write, has ink, not can write, has ink inside. Why is it then important if I can't write with it just because there's ink inside? Yeah, thank you. Thank you, DG.
DG, I would like you to show your slides up there because so that I can see my voice. I'm going to be pointing on slides and ask you to. Slide number 13 is the first one. That graph, you probably have to educate us because we've always known that the triplets that have just got challenges is Limpopo, KwaZulu-Natal, and Eastern Cape. Now, that slide is showing that Free State is performing worse than the triplets. Now, you probably need to help me to understand those reasons. Slide number 20 is the next one. I'm surprised that we are still using that selection, social determinants of health, and we have a variable there that talks about people missing school who are 20 years and that age. Now, in this day and age, do we still have people who would be 20 years old not going to school? Now, isn't that graph supposed to go higher? Because I would imagine after democracy, nobody must be still sitting at home. We must arrest those people and send them to school because the schools are free to go to. I mean, why would have a warm boat in South Africa to date? Of course, it's not our data, it comes from somewhere. But I'm asking, why would they, in this democracy, have people who cannot go to school, at least up to grade 3 or 4 or 5? So maybe we'll be able to answer, but it's another question. Now, on slide 21, it's a criticism that men do not use health facilities. I'm not sure whether you could actually explore on some of the things that we have seen. Provinces that have actually expanded on this program by catching males coming in from work in the taxi ranks, has there been any improvement? Because if they don't come to our clinics, and can't you catch them wherever they are? What has been your experience with that one? Like the 23 and 24 combined, the role of community healthcare workers in really punching holes to the laws to follow up, and if there's any correlation on districts that have got a low number of community healthcare workers and the flourishing of TB and HIV, say, for those are the ones that are the foot soldiers that can combat that quickly. Slide 25 is not a nice story to hear. That we have moved out of being an E8 elimination malaria status as a country. But I don't think you should only blame Limpopo for that, because there are certain indicators in even in KwaZulu-Natal that what probably you thought they were doing well 2 years ago, they may just be pointers. We just want to say, please, focus on the malaria in the country, because there are certain countries in the world that have really eliminated malaria. Why do you put yourself on a trajectory of eliminating malaria and suddenly things fall apart and we are now going to, because there was a reason, then there was a plan in place to make sure that we eliminate malaria, but those chances now are not there. Slide 26. Hey, this slide is a worry. It gives an impression that we're focusing on communicable disease, and we are done well. And the slides are showing that we have done very well in terms of HIV, TB. Mm. But somebody was just resting about non-communicable disease. And the last guy, I'm going to the church. She's not, she's out. You see, the books that I read that were borrowed to me by Dr. Kemi Chetty and Dr. Perry Kisnasamy will show you, and about Dr. Glenda must help us, they will show you that in 1980, Professor Y.K. Sidda wrote a book that said, if my Nkwazulu Natal and you are looking for hypertension, don't go to Mlazi and Guamash. You must go to Chatsworth and Durban North. It doesn't matter, it doesn't matter anymore. You can go to Wamashu, you find the same hypertension as you find in Chatsworth. But 30 years ago, there was no hypertension in Wamashu. So it means we watch an epidemic going up, we're focusing on one epidemic and this one we are not. So I don't know whether I'm asking the right person or maybe Glenda must help us here to say, why are we having this situation like this in the country where we seem to be doing well on one epidemic, pushing it down, but we watch the other epidemic going up and we say, look, somebody else will come from some other planet to deal with that part. Slide number 28, piggybacking on Honorable Wilson's question. It will be important so that whatever mechanism, whatever things that we have put in place on the oncology in the country, not only on just the things he was asking about, but Mpumalanga, we check countrywide. How are we doing it? I mean, the province that I led had its own challenges. Are we backsliding there, or are we maintaining an up? So we need to really make sure. I don't know whether we prepare ourselves to ask in provinces when they visit us, but yourself too can just prepare that we will be very keen to know on that slide 28. On slide, the other slide that was asked about the Cuban program, it will be important to update us as to what is now the attitude of universities. The Cuban program was an avenue out of people not interested to improve the numbers, and that's why Honorable Van Staden is asking, why are we having shortages of doctors? So if we ask the universities, can you improve? They said, no, we don't have capacity, we're not going to do that. Has that changed? But the second part of that, there was an interest to say, even if you were to then come up to close or tailor down the Cuban program, but that model that they are using there is a model that will still want to carry on with it, maybe inside the country, focus on primary health care. What is your story on that one? Slide number 84. Who makes a decision of this money comes to provinces allocated. Who makes decisions that, because we are saying that three provinces that are doing well in terms of improving their budget allocation, but there are those that are stationary. Who makes the decision in provinces that don't increase budget for health, push more to this and that? I don't know. I wish you would help me. Slide number 98. I'm not sure whether you're able to share with us the success stories around the arrest at Umtata, or that is still kept confidentially, on the medical legal issues, because there seem to have been lawyers, they were really making a kill at the expense of our department. So how is that? Because we are making mistakes, but people are waiting there, but maybe they'll share that one. Slide 108. I just think, Ms. Matsoso, you are making a very conservative statement about Mom Connect. I have not heard this department priding itself about Mom Connect. Because really, if I were to read what is written here, what is Mom Connect? It's where you register a pregnant mother. You deliver to her targeted state-based health information. You help her to understand what is postpartum hemorrhage. It enables her to press, to reach out with questions that are pressing on her while she's pregnant. It establishes an important feedback loop to improve health services. Now, I have not heard in the country where you are talking so much about Mamkonegos. It would be important to compare before this tool was put in place and after. Has there been an improvement in the maternal mortality with the introduction of this tool? We don't hear such stories. Just report Mamkonegos. But there was a time there was no Mamkonegos in the country. How has it helped us in terms of going forward? I think now I must go to the last question again, slide 128. DJ, this light, can you show it up there? Oh, yeah. This down. Okay.
No.
Colleagues, look at slide number 128 in our program. It's not fair to keep quiet about this story because I don't know where you link up this. Women who are pregnant, almost all provinces without fail, are showing that women who are pregnant in our country are accessing our clinics before they are 5 months pregnant. At least 60% of women. There are provinces that are doing exceptionally well, that are almost above 75%. Now, where are we going to get this link to say, when we encourage, who is doing this? I don't know who. Is it community healthcare workers? Or is it just women motivated? Whoever is doing it. If women are so motivated to come to our clinics before 5 months of pregnancy, and they are coming in big numbers, and we're able to pick up women who probably might be HIV positive or TB and start treating them early, and we are impacting on their PMTCT, where is the department to link up these things and actually continue to actually impress upon women that please do this even more, because this department once upon a time was saying we are hit with 30% on antenatal care before 20 weeks. Now, we are doing it at 70, and we are not writing good stories out of that thing, and we are really not making yourself feel good when you finish. Colleagues, what's going to happen now? We are going to break for lunch. Lunch is there. Lunch is outside. We are going to break for lunch, and who teach you will be the first one to eat, because you must come back and respond. But can I just make another small change? When she comes back, please, DG, you start with this 20-page summary of the entities, so that if members have got questions, but this is just to refresh ourselves for the next meeting, then you go to your questions. So when you come back, start with the presentation on the entities, then you then answer our questions. DG?
Before we break for lunch, I had intended to say that you'll see that I did not have anything on mental health, because I thought it would be actually be doing a disservice for such an issue that is of such public health importance, and that we need to present in a much more comprehensive manner, and also share some of the reports on what that has been done. So I would prefer that we have a dedicated session for that. And you said that in your opening, but I thought I needed to also reinforce that.
Colleagues, that culturally tell us with what we have been thinking, that those outstanding issues, maybe we'll agree as a committee that on the day they come back again, mental health issues care in the country will be one, and maybe she can link that up with any other topic, but we'll just dedicate that to her. Okay, colleagues, it's 1:10 now. We come back at 22:02, so 30 minutes of lunch with bathrooms, and no more people are smoking now. No. And just walking about.